Every aspect of our culture, our government, and the very soul of the United States is currently on the line. Real change is possible like never before. The Dream Corps is stepping up to find solutions, create opportunities for servant leadership, and ignite our souls. They are working to change this national breakdown into a breakthrough. Dream Corps helps to advance solutions that inspire action, serve justice, and improve people's lives. Their solutions honor life, and they work to amplify the voices of those left behind in the current system and in the current conversations. They believe that turning to each other instead of on each other will result in our acting in solidarity. It will create unlikely partnerships and open unexpected doors. Stay with me to learn the how of all of this from Vien Trong, who is a force and who is leading the charge to cultivate presence, conviction, and love with authenticity, depth, and passion. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Happy that you're here and happy to have you as our listeners because we're building quite a tribe ourselves. So please join me in welcoming our guest for this next hour, Vien Trong. She is the CEO of Dream Corps, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about her. When I was in the, what I said in the intro that she's a force, I really meant it. She's a solutions innovator, she's a movement builder, and she's been a key architect to building an equitable green economy. What a concept. She has developed numerous energy, environmental, and economic policies and programs at the state, federal, and local levels. Vien has advised on billions of dollars in public investments for energy and community development programs. And most recently, Vien led a coalition to pass and implement California's landmark Senate Bill 535, a law that created the biggest fund in history for the poorest and most polluted communities. To date, it has invested over $800 million in disadvantaged communities most harmed by fossil fuel pollution. She also co-led Charge Ahead California, which sounds so much like her leading the charge, which will place 1 million electric vehicles to California in 10 years, especially ensuring that low-income communities most impacted by pollution will benefit from zero tailpipe emissions. And that was yesterday. So let's see what she is up to now and learn a bit more about her and about Dream Corps. And Vien, I think you can tell by my enthusiasm. I'm so glad to have you back with us for another hour. I get you all to myself.
Thank you for having me. I love our conversations always, so it's so great to be on again.
I do too. I was smiling prepping for the show and said, I'm going to ask her this, and I'm going to ask her this, and I want to know what she thinks about this. So let's get to those stories. And I think it's best if we start with you sharing a little bit about Dream Corps. I love your mission. It's simple and extremely powerful. The Dream Corps works to close prison doors and open doors of opportunities. So tell us, Dream Corps, what is it? Why is it? Why are you working to change the world?
Well, thank you so much. And if folks are interested, our website is thedreamcorps.org. And that's right, our mission is to close prison doors and open doors of opportunity. And the way we do that is through four of our programs. One, Cut 50, reducing prison population in half in 10 years. We passed 8 state policies this year alone, and we're on the cusp of passing something federally that would reduce prison punishment and begin looking at how to rehabilitate and restore people. Our Yes We Code program, which we co-founded with Van Jones and Prince, the artist, before he passed, is to connect 100,000 young people from underserved communities into opportunities in the tech future. Our Green for All program, which of course you know so much about, is creating a green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. And finally, our Love Army, which was created right after the Trump election, was to heal the division in this country, the hate among each other. We want to help people turn to each other and not against each other. And within a year, 130,000 people signed on to be participants, 60,000 active volunteers, and 3,000 leaders of volunteers. And that's just the beginning. We're really excited about the amount of work we've done. And again, our website is thedreamcorps.org. and you can find out.
Yeah, you can find a lot about it. About the, and it's a very easy to navigate and exciting website to spend time on. And it's it to me. I thought some genius thought hashtag Yes We Code. I was like, I love that. It fits into every social media platform, and it's such a positive message. But speaking of that, your message of Dream Corps is such a positive one. It is so much needed. I agree with that. But what's your vision for how do we get from here to there? And even I find myself struggling with this one, trying to find hope on some days and finding common ground with people, quite frankly, I would not like to spend time with, but I know it's important. It's tough sometimes. How is your organization going to help people that are wanting to come to the table with the healing and working together? It's a tough one now for me.
It's a tough one, but we look at what are the glimpses of hope that should inspire us to continue moving forward. You know, some of us can look at the election results on Tuesday and just think about all the things that we didn't get. But when we look at it, we saw some reason for us to continue to be hopeful. As our founder, Van Jones, said, there was a rainbow wave across the country. Government is now going to be more representative of many people in this country. We're seeing new leaders, younger, browner, more women, more veterans that are going to be helping to govern in areas from the Deep South to the Midwest. We saw the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, the first Indigenous woman elected to Congress, the first Latinas in Texas moving to Congress. Over 100 women now are going to serve in Congress. So all of these things are reason to be excited. I think one of the things that I want to go back to in your first question was, you know, what are we doing? What is the work of the Dream Corps? Beyond our mission statement, fundamentally, what we believe is we deserve in this country a more fair and sustainable future, one that creates opportunities across the country, no matter who you voted for, no matter what party lines you're on, across race and gender. We believe, as Sojourner Truth said, until all of us are free, none of us are. And what we want to do is uplift each other in getting off the sidelines and doing the work together and helping to build the future for this country. And the grassroots turnout this election cycle proved that when we do, we can really change history.
And that's what we have to hold that space and hope for. And what, like, when you say that, and I, like, I'm reeling from the election results, and you put a very positive spin on it. I'm happy, and I don't like it when people are calling it the pink wave. I really like rainbow better. But it's like there is a day of celebration for women and how far we've come, and women of every race, color, and creed. And to me, that is one of the positives. And then where do I put it in my head? And I don't want this to sound like a counseling session for Gina, but about what's going on in Georgia. There's so much, you know, you can't even call it shenanigans because that lightens the impact. There's dirty, nasty, intentional sabotage going on in a place like Georgia. Where do you put that in terms of going forward and finding the common ground? It's hard for me.
I agree. I mean, it would be naive for us to say that these things are not demoralizing. And for me, I understand the importance of maintaining our fortitude, and in order to do so, the importance of understanding the work in an unvarnished way, the work that is needed to continue moving forward, but also to keep some hope, right? All work is dependent on hope, or else we're just going to, you know, without hope, the feeling of apathy and hopelessness will set in, and then we just are going to sit on our couch and eat popcorn and drink wine.
Right, right.
For me, when I think about the record turnout that came out,
yes,
the fact that we had really Obama and Oprah, I mean, and all of the people who came to Georgia to say, no, everybody, go out, do the work. When we saw the record turnout by women, by people of color, the exciting gubernatorial candidate that is Stacey, all of those things, I think, was really, really a reason for us to see things are moving, and that we're not going to sit down and shut up, that we're going to continue to do the work moving forward. And when we do that, I think we can see some really good stuff happening.
And even with Texas, with Beto O'Rourke, the fact that he got as many votes as he did in Texas is so significant. And to me, it's not so much that a Republican won and a Democrat lost. It was the strength of showing there are two-party systems possible again. That's how I felt. It's like for all of these almost won, people were stepping up and we need a two-party system. And we didn't have that for the past 2 years. So that gave me hope. Of course, I wanted him to win, but I can't believe how far he came in Texas.
Yeah. Well, I just want to make a small note that as a 501c3, we don't endorse any candidates.
Right. Okay.
Of course, I personally might have opinions, but we can't and we don't. For us, though, when we look at whether it's Texas or Florida or Georgia, Maryland, and a number of other places across the country, what we saw was a shift in strategy, and that's exciting. Before, we were seeing a lot of candidates really heavily invest in TV ads that were expensive and really weren't reaching the grassroots. And now we're beginning to see more grassroots organizing, more results that were healing the divisions, that were getting people coming out to be more engaged than ever before. I think that's the bright spot we're beginning to see in this election. Hopefully that continues for the next 2 years, moving into 2020. The thousands of leaders and organizers that hit the ground really proved that results happen, that change happens when people get out of the doors. When I walked to I hobbled to my voting place because I sprained my foot. And I was like, nothing was going to keep me home. And I came out there, and on a midterm election, there was a lot of excitement. There's a lot of big people who were there. I asked the person why, you know, what brought him to vote today. And he said, you know, he didn't want to be ever again just sitting at home complaining. He wanted to get into the work, actually do the work, and show to his students, he was a security guard at a school, he wanted to show the students at the school that we have to be engaged if we're really going to care about these issues. So that new turning tide makes me hopeful.
It makes me hopeful too. There was really a lot of hope. And to me, it was definitely forward momentum on many, many fronts. And that's what we have to focus on to keep going. So
go
ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and there were some good stuff that happened on the issues. In Oregon, our Green for All team worked with local leaders to successfully pass the Portland Clean Energy Initiative. And that is now creating $30 million for clean energy programs in underserved communities there. So that's exciting stuff. A number of other campaigns. So, for instance, in Florida, we helped to register and turn out community members, especially those that were hit by recent hurricanes and storms that were there. And together with local organizations, we helped to move forward a dialogue that this isn't just a climate issue, it's also an economic issue. Part of the work that we did in the turnout, we were excited to see, also led to getting passed with the support of 1.4 million people moving Amendment 4 forward, which means that where before anyone who had a past felony conviction couldn't have voted for life.
Right.
Now
that was
okay.
So
now
great. Yes. That was celebrate good times. Oh my gosh, I was so happy. There was cheering in our family when that one came on. And that was a significant vote in terms of numbers even. There was like, yeah, people don't want us to be wasting people's lives forever because of what they did how many years ago. That was a big victory. And even in Arizona, exactly. We had some victories, like there was an education bill that was clearly going to, for the most part, decimate our public education system in favor of charter schools and private schools, and it failed, and it failed big time. So there was a real cry for and support for public education, and that made me do the happy dance. But what about, as someone that's very, very interested in climate change, as I am, did you find, at least at the national level, a severe absence of conversations about climate change? I mean, healthcare reform was a big one, and it's critical, and it has to do with climate change. But I was amazed a lot at the lack of conversation, especially given the IPCC report, you know, in October that said, folks, we have about 12 years to turn this around. So did you find the same thing? Like, where is the conversation around climate change?
I agree. I felt the profound silence around climate change issues. And for us, I think that the strategy for many people has been to move away from a federal push just because we see the hurdles that have been placed there. And a lot of this work is now happening in state levels where a lot of continued progress can happen. I think on the federal front, we have to start really communicating that this isn't just the one of the biggest climate issues that we're facing, one of the most biggest threats from the Department of Defense to many people who are working on the front lines. We're sharing this information. We're seeing families who were pushed out of Puerto Rico because of the hurricanes and storms. We're now seeing that happening. We're seeing climate refugees inside of the United States.
Right.
And we're not talking about that. And we're going to see even worse outcomes coming. But if we continue to talk about the problems, I think people are feeling a little bit like overwhelmed about what is happening and not quite sure knowing what they can do. So we have to communicate to, here's what we can do, right? We can invest in solutions. We can invest in renewable energy, electrifying vehicles and electrifying our grids, making sure that we're investing in access for the communities that are hit first and worst by climate change disasters, seeing the economic opportunities around that. So climate change costs us a lot of money to our wallet books, right? The increased cost of energy, the increased cost of water shortages, all of those things hit our wallet and our pocketbooks. But we can also see an opportunity in creating jobs. We can also see an opportunity in reducing the cost if we invest in renewable energy for low-income households. Now, one of the families that we got free solar panels to, their electricity bill dropped from $200 on average a month to $1.50 overnight, because they were able to now be on renewable energy and not dependent on this fluctuating cost of gas and oil. So we got to do better as communicators around this country, around both the threats of climate change, but really the opportunity too for our families who are especially vulnerable to these issues.
And we all win. When that happens, we all win. It's to me, it is a no-brainer. So to that point, the impact, I'm talking a lot more these days about climate adaptation, because there are lots of programs in the country now focused on, like you said, those higher risk areas without access to heating and cooling, where they are really implementing strategies to help protect those families, to put a buffer for the impact of climate change. But given all that, where are some of the key areas that you think we need to focus our energy? I'm a big people, we have to preserve the rainforest. So that's far away, but our oxygen supply, it comes a lot from there. It cools the oceans and on and on. There are lots of people there. But in terms of the immediate needs, what are some of your thoughts on where do we need to focus our energies when it comes to climate change or climate adaptation and mitigating it?
Well, I think that is a huge issue, mitigation and adaptation. And what we saw, everybody still remembers Katrina and what happened to New Orleans. And when we saw that happen, there was no coordinated response to make sure that we were really working with the communities to rebuild in a healthy and sustainable way. There are bright spots and opportunities within that. We've seen communities that were hit by climate disasters actually then organize and make sure that the public contracts to rebuild goes to the local community members, and that the contracts are going to local businesses, that the jobs are going to local people, and that it is funded and invested to create the vision that they want to see the community be rebuilt to be. When that happens, the community can actually be more sustainable economically and environmentally. So I think once we do the adaptation and mitigation, the adaptation work right, there can be a way to do it in a smart way that moves a community forward and not just keep them the way that we continue to see in New Orleans, disinvested and neglected and kind of turned a blind eye around. So I think that's really key. For me, I also want to make sure that we're making sure the big polluters are cleaning up and paying up to invest in rebuilding and repairing the damage that they've done. Part of the work that we've seen in California is when we do that, it allows for our state to actually move forward economically. So we passed this law you mentioned in my bio, Senate Bill 535. We call that the climate credit. We have a program now in California that makes big polluters clean up and pay up, right? They have to clean up their act. They have to invest more in renewable energy. They have to reduce the amount of pollution that they're pumping out into the lungs and the lives of low-income community members and across the board, all of Californians. And if they can't clean up fast enough, they also have to invest in the very community so that it can support solar programs, affordable housing by transit hubs, investing in urban forestry, so trees planted across the state. We were investing in all of these programs. The law passed in 2012. At the time, California was seventh or eighth as the largest economy in the world. Now it is fifth. And it has been years in implementation. I mean, we are now a bigger economy in California than Great Britain. And so what is proven?
That's unreal. It's like,
unreal?
Take a minute here. They're bigger than the country. Yes.
Right. Than the UK. And so what is proven is that these programs are not a hit to the economy. Actually, it can catapult you forward because it has now allowed for us to reduce the cost and improve the quality of living for our citizens.
And you know, as I'm sitting here very intently listening, this is where I want to just reach out and get into people's heads and say, this is for the greater good. Everybody wins in a green economy. There are more sustainable jobs. There isn't the impact of pollution from fracking, and the beat goes on to clean up. Everybody wins. We breathe cleaner air. More people pay taxes. There's less crime. This is the win-win-win that if we all got our head around, that change could happen more quickly, I believe, because it's just taking the whole big picture into consideration for all our sakes.
Exactly. I mean, I would love to see a future where we're not outsourcing our funds and our jobs to oil extractions in the Middle East, but instead investing in local jobs. What if we said, you know, why don't we retool the car manufacturing factories that were now, you know, pushed out of the country? But what if we retool those shops instead into building wind turbines and give those jobs to local people? What if we actually invested in local manufacturing and able to help create, you know, everything from electric buses to solar panels to other programs that actually is good for our climate, but also help to build and invest in our local communities? You know, right now, coal country, we've lost so much coal because, you know, the price points don't pan out.
Right,
and what if we invested money instead in diversifying the local economy, right? And we can help create jobs there for people to actually see the vision and the sustainability for their state, for their community, for their families. Like, that's the future that makes me excited.
Yeah, it makes me excited too, and it just makes sense. The numbers work. The you know, everything that's really good and beneficial for the planet works, and I just think we just have to keep going at it. Perfect segue. I was at the Global Climate Action Summit. I certainly got to see you in action. The force, may the force be with you. It's VN right here.
Thank you.
What were some of the biggest takeaways for you? And before you answer that, it was an amazing experience, which when you're doing what I do and what you're doing every day, it filled my well instead of me giving. It was like I was getting filled up. And I asked some of my friends that came from, that were professors at the U of A, what did you think? Was it all hype? Will the agreements be followed through on? Because I walked away feeling very good, but I wanted to know what your takeaway was. Does this kind of thing have lasting impacts?
I think it has a lot of lasting impacts in ways that people may not even know or see. Let me say, for instance, I got to see Ed Norton and Terry Tanneman, who used to run the EPA in California. They had a conversation around what their takeaways were. And I love that Ed Norton said, you know, across the board, when he was listening to all of these panels and all of these discussions, what he had heard very clearly is the need to invest in local community leaders.
Yes.
To be the leaders to help talk about what were the problems in their communities and help to create the solutions. And in a room full of kind of presidents were there, you know, former presidents of various countries were there. And that was the takeaway that many people walked away from. And, you know, I hope that that means then more and more investments then are going to local community groups and local community solutions. So that was exciting. I also took away some amazing leaders, kind of sparks of inspiration. I was moderating, as you might know, the equity track with the Global Climate Action Summit. So I was, you know, facilitating a conversation with the woman who was the head of the UN work on responding to climate refugees and immigrants
yes.
and indigenous people.
Yes.
I was, you know, moderating a talk with Mia Yoshitani, who runs Asian Pacific Environmental Network, with the woman who is running Black Mesa Coalition, and a number of just amazing folks, you know, Robert Bullard, Javier Becerra, who is the Attorney General for California. So amazing people. But I will say the woman who just inspired me the most is actually 16 years old, and she runs Zero Hour, Jamie. And Jamie came in and just said, you know, I just got to tell you guys that I am supposed to be in school right now. I'm actually skipping school and probably going to get dinged. But why am I here? I'm here because you adults in this room have failed me, that I can't even vote. But you are leaving me with the burden and my generation with the burden of cleaning up your mess. And I am here upset, angry, and not only that, but really working to create a national coalition of other young people who are now saying we want to push further on climate action. And, you know, sometimes young people speak the truth in ways that are uncomfortable. And just by her clarity and her truth, it made us all just remark on the fact that this is not just talking points. This isn't just a show. This is very, very real. So I left, continue to think about her today.
And I left with a lot of those impressions, and there were a lot of solutions. But it, again, for me, it was encouraging to see the number of women on panels with their thought leadership. The diversity factor was definitely there. And I love the young people. They inspire me. It's like, yes, there's hope. They're going to keep fighting. They've got it in them. I went to the one session. This guy was, you know, he's rebuilding coral reefs in the Bahamas that people from all over the world are coming to look at. So there were so many good things of hope that we all need for solutions, and I hope. And what I've told people is when you see some of what I call the big dogs that are on the stage, you have the mayor of Paris, and who needed a stool. She's so short, and it was adorable But I have to say that, but she's a force. Like she said, here's what's going on in Paris, to people like Al Gore and his passionate speech, and Bloomberg and the head of Salesforce and Jane Goodall. It was just encouraging to see a lot of thought leaders I respect there advocating for substantive change. So I was really happy that mm-hmm. I got to go. So let's segue a little bit, because when you and I last spoke, and I didn't get a chance to re-listen to the show, but I actually remember a lot of it, there was a lot of action around Flint, Michigan. Well, mm-hmm. then fast forward, I was struggling with the right words. I wasn't really happy to see Michael Moore's latest film, Fahrenheit 11/9. It's not what I would call a feel-good movie. It's a must-see movie. And one of the things I love is he really took a very hard to look at times, in-depth look at Flint, Michigan. And I know that's a big one for you. I know it's a big one for Ben Jones. Mm-hmm. Bring us mm-hmm. up to date from your perspective about what's going on there and lead efforts in general. I mean, lead's a deadly killer forever. So what are you seeing mm-hmm. in now, like November of 2018?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, a lot of not enough has been done, and a lot of families and residents are still dealing with lead in their pipes. The water has been switched over back to the Detroit water. So, you know, the problem we saw in Flint was a result of the city moving the water source that residents in the community were getting from the Detroit water, which is safe and clean, to the Flint River water, which isn't, but could have been okay if they put in an anti-corrosive chemical
right.
that would have protected them from having the pipes, the lead pipes, from being atrophied. And now that those pipes are not yet fixed. And even though the water switched back to Detroit water, the continued problem with the lead in the pipes that is leaking water into the household, that has not been fixed. And a lot of money needs to be invested in it in order for that to happen. Green for All and our Dream Corps team were able to make a call to the country, working with influencers from our founder, Van Jones, to Common, to Jaden Smith, and Karichi Tran, and many others who stepped up and said, let's work together. We donated all of our staff time and resources, and these influencers did the same as well. From that, we were able to raise the money to help 19 households change out their boilers. And this is important. We asked them, what would they have us do with these investments? We can give it to them. We can, you know, help them change out one home or two home or three homes and the pipes there. And they said, no, actually, what's most important is to help us change out these boilers so that we can actually have some usable water in our kitchen and in our bath. So great. We helped to do that for 19 homes. And when we're talking with them, it continues to be an issue of long-term investments. People really have forgotten about Flint. I saw Gina McCarthy, of course, who used to be the U.S. Administrator for an Environmental Protection Agency. And I asked, you know, what happened with Flint? You know, how did they, where there was a problem of having them communicate their issues and be heard by the EPA. And she said, there was no way that they could get to me. That there was a barrier, you know, because of the hierarchy and the setup of the EPA agency of that size, it was a barrier for people in Flint to really get their voices to me. They didn't have a way to raise their voice. And that's the work now that we're trying to help around this country, because not only Flint, but across the country, people are dealing with lead in their water. People are dealing with lead in their paint chips that is getting into the bloodstreams of kids. And so we are now helping to uplift voices of moms and kids and families across this country so that they can actually speak up, be heard. We're creating a platform to support that. On our website at greenforall.org, you'll see a Moms Mobilize effort, which allowed for us to uplift the voices of moms and to help share what is happening in the community that they are seeing and what are the solutions that they want to see. And not only moms, but also kids. And just to close out on this, the reason why we think this is really important, to your point earlier, Gina, we're dealing now with so many political kind of acrimony around climate change issues. It's a profound silence nationally and federally. And we think that part of it is because people have seen this as a left issue or democratic issue. And we want to make sure that people see this as a human rights issue, yes, a health issue, yes, a child protection issue. And by focusing on uplifting moms' voices and kids' voices to speak for themselves and not having me or others speak for them, then that allows for them to actually talk about this in a very real way.
And having those voices be heard. You know, I just want to foray into this a little bit. The other day, I interviewed a really incredible and powerful guest who honestly and truly, he got inside my head. And his show hasn't aired yet, but his name is Xavier Ramey from Justice Informed in Chicago. And he talked about the need for more what some people would call uncomfortable conversations. And I said to him on the air, I said, you know what, Xavier, I'm in. Because what he talked about is the conversations about how much of what is wrong in this country in particular, we were focused on that, is really there is the underlying conversation around racism. So for Flint, Michigan, and he said, we have to have the conversations. Was that tragedy going on at Flint, continuing to go on, where 6 to 10,000 children have been impacted forever? It's not like they're processing the lead. It'll be three generations before that happens. Do you think if it was a rich white community, or any rich, was it poverty or racism or a combination of both? You know, and he inspired me to ask some of those questions of guests like you, because you're not afraid to have some uncomfortable conversations and bring us back to the promise of working together. So what are your thoughts on that? Why was it ignored? Why is it not being talked about still? Why isn't it fixed?
Exactly. And we know that race plays a key issue in this, right? Because in communities across the country, when it is a predominantly affluent or a white community, the response has always been much more immediate.
Yes.
And much more long-term. We see that not only in addressing climate change issues, but also gun shooting and violence in communities, right? When it's a predominantly white or affluent school, the response is much more in-depth and comprehensive. And when it's communities of color or low-income students, it hasn't been the same. And we think, you know, when we see what happens in Flint, the response has been, well, those are communities that nobody cares about, right? And I'm not just saying this as hyperbole. There's been many studies that says the siting of polluting facilities, waste management, water treatment facilities, they're often picked to be sited in low-income communities or communities of color because they don't have, because the assumption is they either don't have the political voice where they can actually do something about it if, you know, there's a problem or to protest the siting of it in the first place, or because they are deemed to be able to, their lives are less valuable, right? And so that's what we're trying to counter, and that's what we're pushing up against, because it is fundamentally unfair, and it is a truncated morality if we don't do something about this. You know, I grew up in a low-income community. I continue to raise my kids in Oakland, California, near Fruitvale. And we, you know, our lives are projected to be 12 years less by virtue of where we live, both because of the underinvestment, because of the proximity to busy highways and freeways, because of the amount of pollution that we're dealing with, but also the lack of access to healthy fruits and vegetables and other resources. And so for me, this is something that I care about, and it's very personal. And these issues are so intertwined, race, environment, they're so intertwined. And unless we deal with them together, we're really never going to have real solutions that would work. And it shouldn't be seen as a problem just for those people or just those communities, because guess what? There is no wall high enough to block out air pollution.
Yes.
You know, the problems that we're seeing in Flint, when it was first just a problem dealing with the low-income communities in Flint, it was seen as not as big an issue. But it turns out now that even the affluent community members are seeing the lead problems in their households, in their communities. And now they cannot deal with it by themselves because it's a community-wide issue. And their homes are now tanking. It's worthless because, I mean, who wants to buy a house with poisoned water?
Right,
and
right.
So they're seeing rapid foreclosures. So we can't turn a blind eye to this. There's no wall high enough. These water issues are prevalent throughout the communities. And we have to begin to see each other as each other's brother's keepers, right, to be able to be accountable to supporting each other. I think when we do that right and well, we protect ourselves as well as others.
So it just leads to the other part of the question, going back to the climate change conversation being missed, you know, kind of absent. Like, where was it? Oh, radio silence on climate change. But when it comes to combating climate change, it's kind of the same question. You and I know that climate change is already killing people. People are starving. They're dying of thirst or hunger. They're permanently being displaced from their homes. And that's a big one for me, because some people in conversations, and this goes back to Xavier talking about the real conversation, said to me with some of these hurricanes and in Puerto Rico, why didn't they get out? And I just look and I say, do you know, like, if you got out, you could put it on your American Express and you could go to your cousin's house in Colorado. A lot of these people, there isn't a plan B. They don't have the money to travel. Even in some of the areas in Texas mm-hmm. and Florida, what are they going to do? Go to their second home? Oh, that's right. They barely are holding on to their first one. So this is a segue. That was like a mini rant.
I want to maybe touch on that little
yes,
bit and then connect
yes.
that to the previous question, because not only that, but remember the fires that we were seeing in Santa Barbara and Southern
yes,
California
yes.
and in Northern California. These fires, a lot of them were because of the huge problem that we're dealing with, drought, right, which was sparked by climate change
yes.
issues. And a lot of these communities were affluent. And they did not have advance warning. They had no idea these fires would spread as quickly as they did. Some people were waking up in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. The fire's right outside their doors. They had to hop into their cars and race out.
Right.
And these were people, even if they could afford it, there was no way they could have been able to plan for what had happened. And you saw people lose their homes and in some cases lose their lives because of these climate change issues, because of the drought issues. So, yeah, some people, they can put it on their American Express and fly out. But that even in cases where people can have the American Expresses and afford it, they couldn't, right? And so let's talk about the real issue of there's no real escape. You might be able to delay it being a personal issue to you, but really there's no escape from this being a personal issue to all of us. You know, if not already immediately, which most people are already feeling it in their pocketbooks, in the cost of dollars, in the lack of access to resources, but if not today, then tomorrow, right? And or the next year, or, you know, in 12 years, as IPCC was telling us, oh, God, sadly. And I just want us to say, you know, it's easy to be sitting there in fear and in apathy or in kind of like, you know, doing the ostrich thing and putting our head in the sand. But what if we just looked at it in this uncomfortable way, as you were saying, Xavier was saying, like, let's just sit in the discomfort for a minute and let's just let that motivate us to figure out, well, not only in how do we respond in the most minimal of way of buying our own home insurance or, you know, having our own escape plan, but what if we just responded by saying, how can we actually use this as an opportunity to be even stronger as a country, to actually find a way to work together, to actually find a way to understand how we can actually have this be a catalyst to leapfrog into the future and invest in real sustainable solutions the way that most countries are already doing. You know, we unfortunately have federal and national leaders deny that climate change is real. But what if we actually had, you know, whether or not you believe in whether it's man-made or not, and many scientists, 97% think it is.
Right.
But even if you said it isn't, we should have an insurance plan and invest in opportunities. It's a great economic opportunity to actually do something to counter and respond to these issues.
And just at a very local level, in Tucson, we have a very severe labor shortage, very, to the point where, like, our Tucson airport put out two bids to for construction. In their history, they have never gotten zero responses. And the person who runs it, Bonnie Allen, said it has never happened. And when they questioned some of their tried and true contractors, they said, we don't have the workforce. They're in Texas working on the hurricane cleanups. So I want to shout to the business owners, yes, it's impacting us everywhere. Nobody, there's no wall big enough. There's no escaping what's happening because of climate change, which then brings me back to beating the dead horse of why isn't it more front and center of the part of conversation? Because nothing really else matters if we don't get a handle on this. So is part of it, this is another one of those, let's dig a little deeper here with Vienne. Do you think it's being ignored by the people in power because it hasn't hit them hard enough yet? What is it going to take to get everybody's attention? Wildfires like never before didn't do it. Flooding like never before didn't do it. Tornadoes, just wind storms. We have things in Arizona called haboobs that knock out entire interstates for hours. Stuff like they had to make up that word to talk about what it was. So that I sit in this chair day after day interviewing people like you that are really have a finger on many pulses. What is it going to take to like get us all moving in the same direction and everybody wins? I thought disasters would say, oh, see, look what happened. Miami's flooding. And it's, yeah. And look at the West is on fire. Oh, that's going to be it. But it doesn't seem as though we have enough attention, or am I looking in the wrong box?
Well, no, I think that's right. And I think there's a lot of reasons why. Naomi Klein, a great book that talks about climate change.
Yep.
Talked about how the Cato Institute strategy was always to push doubt into the reality of climate change. And by doing so, they can stall any real big response, any the necessary response to address this issue, right? Because if we believe, as is true, that climate change is real, then the response has to be a big, you know, comprehensive solution by public, private, and leaders across the country. And as people who are pushing for small government, this was counter to what they wanted to see. And so they said, we can't say it's not true, but why don't we just push scout into it? And their strategy has worked. It has been a delayed response at the federal and national levels, especially by conservatives. And that's exactly why we're moving away from it being a political issue and into something that that is a common sense child protection issue and economic right. opportunity for many states. I also want to say that while what we're seeing at the national level is happening, there is a huge role that our private sector players can play here. We saw a lot of people from Paris Treaty Agreement to the response post-Trump really stepping in, Google and Apple both committing 100% renewable energy to fund their data storage facilities. That is the leadership we want to see across the board with private sector partners. I'm happy to say that we have partnered with ECOS, Earth-Friendly Products, led by Kelly Blahakis, African-American woman, CEO of this family-owned company. They are the first ever manufacturing company that creates earth-friendly products from detergents to pet products. And they're water neutral, waste neutral, and carbon neutral. And they give their employees a living wage globally, which is amazing.
Whoa.
And it's run by a black woman.
I know. And what's the name of it? What did you say the name of it was?
It's Earth-Friendly Products.
Okay.
And yeah.
Writing it down.
We're partnering. Yeah. And she should definitely be on your show.
Yes.
She's amazing. Definitely a force. So we're partnering together. And I mentioned earlier that we're looking at how do we uplift the voices of kids. Well, one thing that we're doing is doing an art contest. Because, you know, right now I find there's a huge problem with a lack of creativity. And people are sitting in, oh my God, the world is falling apart. But I want us to begin thinking about what can the world look like? What actually do we want the world to look like? Because unless you have a vision for it, you can't make it happen. And I wanted to make sure that we're supporting our kids in doing so. And so our art contest asked our kids to paint pictures of what do they want this world to look like? What is their dream for the future? And the winning students, the winning kids, will get their labels. They get their pictures on the labels of the detergent bottles of these earth-friendly products, detergent bottles.
Love it.
And next April, you'll be able to see the kids' art contest pictures on the labels. Can you imagine how excited they'll be?
That's the kind of joy we need to see. And if you go to some of these conferences, you get to see that joy. I went to Bioneers also. It was like I was high for about 2 months because I went to the Global Climate Action Summit and a couple of weeks later went to Bioneers, which, as you know, is filled with thought leadership and hope and good things going on. So it's almost like we rehearse this because you were talking about a vision for the future. And my last two questions, I can send you a screenshot. I did not ad lib this. It's like, and then you talked about what's a vision for the future. So the question that I wanted to ask you is when I interview you a year from now, or maybe even 2 years from now, what's your greatest hope for something or things that have changed and that we might have not only looked forward to as a nation, but we're on the path to substantive systemic change? What are some of the most immediate things you'd like to see change in creating this picture of the good fight having achieved some real changes? What's the VN Trung's spin on that?
I would love our leaders, from our public leaders to our private sector leaders, commit to doing better for the environment. California just signed a law, 100% renewable energy. We saw that in Hawaii previously. I would love our states across the board to push for something that ambitious and that's actually realistic. What I would love to see us commit to investing in solutions in communities that are hit first and worst. So, you know, from Salt Lake City to Washington State to New York to Florida and Texas, there are so many communities that are now suffering. while there's a labor shortage, there are many people in those various states that actually are struggling to find a decent, good-paying job.
Yep.
And I would love for that disconnect to actually be healed by our public and our private sector partners working together to have bold, ambitious goals and investing in solutions in the very communities that are dying and neglected and feeling really left behind. I would love for us to invest in real solutions that can move us forward, from electric vehicles to renewable energy to investments in local problems and local needs, whether it's affordable housing to, you know, addressing the food, the urban kind of depletion of natural and good foods for their community members. I would love for us to invest in those very things. I would love to help make sure that our big problem creators are now moving to being problem solvers, right? One of our big polluters are now cleaning up their act and investing in local solutions, creating jobs, supporting job training where that's needed so that we can address this labor shortage and help bring people up. I would love for us to make this issue a 2020 presidential issue. And it doesn't have to be just the gloom and doom, but this can be an opportunity for both sides if we do it right. In 2008, both McCain and Obama said they wanted to support green-collar jobs. Not only the presidential candidates, but also down ticket. I would love for us to see in 2020 that to happen again, that there's a push for this to be an issue that both sides see an opportunity around. And just one thing that I'm really hoping that people are paying attention to now more than ever, we're seeing a huge problem surfacing. We're seeing half of the jobs in this country now being able to be automated, which means more and more jobs will actually be lost.
Right.
And while we're seeing automation and artificial intelligence grow, we're also seeing more and more people take on these contract jobs that don't have health care, that don't have pensions, and people don't have money in their savings account. Most Americans don't have $500 in their bank account now. Most Americans do not have $500 in their bank
account. That's really, really scary. Yep. Yeah.
Petrifying. And then we're seeing automation. And then we're seeing our public evisceration of pensions, our Social Security, our health care protection, our dental care work. So those three things are coming up right now. And we're not having any discussion around what that means. And so Dream Corps is actually creating a summit that is bringing together labor unions, elected leaders, technologists, people across the board who can work together to say, what is actually happening around automation? What is actually happening to our workforce? What are the ways that we can actually bend the trend towards good and mitigate the bad, right? And so I would love for us in the next 2 years to begin to have our public and our private sector partners begin to think about this very, very carefully, because if we don't, we're in really big trouble.
We're in really big trouble. And the only thing that it makes my heart sing, literally, to hear you paint that picture of hope, possibility, and much needed change. And the thing that I would add to that, and I'm sure it's on your list, but, you know, I asked you the question without any time to prepare, is that we will see what you say. And that is many. I'm going to get a little emotional here. I can feel it coming up, but it's near and dear to me. And you know my daughter, Katie Murphy Darling, she remembers you. She lived in LA and she now lives here. And her passion, what she's going to change careers for, is criminal justice reform, because we need to open our prison doors up. We need to get a lot of people out that never should have been there in the first place. Mm-hmm. And talk about racism. Oh my goodness. You know, it's undeniable that there is a big factor. And in Arizona, we ship our prisoners in. We have private prisons, and they're from Hawaii and places around the world, because we have such laws here, you know, beds in the head, and we pay you. So in my 2-year vision, some really big steps in opening those prison doors, which I love that you are about, because that's the social justice part of climate change. We can't have a sustainable planet without a socially just one. So my thanks to you. I just would like to end this show by saying it's people like you that keep me getting up in the morning. And I say that from my heart, inspirational leaders that are touching many lives, encouraging, teaching, and training, inspiring others to do the same. And what I'm going to ask of our listeners is, there are lots of you that I know listen to this show in its entirety. Take the next step and share it. Send the link to someone and say, you know what? Here's a dose of really innovative and powerful thinking, and we all need to be on this page and be an agent for change. So that's my request.
Absolutely.
And my heartfelt thanks. And we have two great upcoming shows. We have our local show with Tim Timur, who's the director of Tucson Water, and we're going to be talking about water resiliency. What's the plan? A big issue in Tucson, and this is another thought leader. He's planning 5, 10, 15 years ahead and leading his team to do the same. And then on December 11th, it's going to be a fun show, and I mean it. These guys are crazy. Grant Reed and Jamie Vandermeer from the Okavango Guiding School in Botswana, Africa. And we're going to talk about training day and what it's like for them in the sub-Saharan part of the world, what they're seeing. So, Vianne, I'm always happy when I get to cross paths with you, and thank you for doing what you're doing. It makes me feel better that I'm in the same world with you.
Me too, Gina. Thank you so much. And I'm so happy to hear about Katie's direction.
I know.
Have her plug in with us. It would be so good.
I know. I will. She's going to be doing the work. Yeah, it's really, really significant. And I'm glad that she's changing direction and got out of the L.A. rat race. So I'll tell her that you sent your best.
Please do. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. Remember, spread the good green word. We all need to. Thank you.